Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Thursday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. It's not good, bad, and crazy martinis today. No, we're in the midst of our year-end awards. The best, the worst, the most, all these sorts of different things to try and make sense of the political year that was 2016. It's an uphill challenge when it comes to putting 2016 into perspective, but we're halfway through, and now we're starting on the second half of our six installments of the year-end awards. Today, we focus on best political idea, worst political idea, and boldest political tactic. So, Jim, what did you have for the best political idea of 2016?
So I have a lot more to say about the worst, but I think the best is pretty clear, and I think there'll be a pretty broad agreement over this. The best idea came from the American people when they looked at all the factors that said that a Hillary Clinton presidency was inevitable, that she had the giant financial advantage, she had the support of all those Hollywood stars, we were told she had a better campaign infrastructure and ground game, she had a unified Democratic Party, or so we thought, she had the president campaigning for her, overwhelming media support, and American people in enough states looked at it and said, nah, nope. Don't want it. And they just said no. And let's face it, from the conclusion of the GOP primaries until late in election night, to a lot of people, Hillary Clinton's victory was considered a foregone conclusion. The safest bet since the best metaphor I could come up with, Greg, was Thomas Dewey in 1948. you know, that basically that this was, you know, this was going to continue the Obama era. The arc of history bends towards justice. That this was part of the inevitable national progress. The demographic changes were making the Democrats the permanent majority party. This was the coalition of the ascendant. And then wait a second, you know, stop the record, freeze frame. And here is Hillary Clinton saying, "You're probably wondering how I ended up here." She is, you know, the triumphant return. It is even, you know, alleged. I don't know if it's ever been confirmed. If you look at the Bill Clinton Presidential Library, it looks like it's built a little bit lopsided, and there's this giant empty lot next to it. And the theory is that the Clintons have always dreamed of having adjoining his and her presidential libraries. And America said, nope, not doing that. Sorry. You know, the stories of them popping champagne on the plane the day before the election, I don't know if that's entirely true, but certainly the Hillary Clinton campaign was totally convinced they had this thing in the bag. That they were going to win the Electoral College by a wide margin. That's why they were telling people, don't waste your time going into Michigan. We've got that locked down. Go to Iowa so Trump will have to spend money and effort there, which, of course, she ended up losing both of those states. Ultimately, for all of the flaws of Donald Trump, and there are many, the country has changed direction, and I think this gives all of us on the right at least a slightly better feeling about the future. We will see what the challenges come, but the country did not reward Hillary Clinton for repeated bad judgment and poor ethics and scandals and everything else she has brought to the job over her roles in public life over the last 25 years. And that is by far the best development of 2016.
That is fantastic. Three times a Clinton has been the Democratic nominee. Zero times have they won a majority of the popular vote. We keep hearing about the popular vote this year.
Yeah.
Never has a Clinton cleared 50%. So I appreciate your macro view there, Jim, because that's obviously the story of the year and the American people who got the steady drumbeat for really over a year about how Hillary Clinton was inevitable, the history-making first woman president, and on and on and on. And they thought for themselves. That is an extremely encouraging sign. They're not just parroting what the media says. Many of them kept their voting intentions to themselves because of the intense backlash that they thought they might get. But ultimately, they went to the ballot box and they rejected not only Hillary Clinton, but the narrative and the record that she has put together and the vision that she laid out in this campaign. So excellent choice. I went to more micro. Donald Trump, of course, did very, very well in the Republican presidential primaries. But one of the big reasons for that, of course, is because there was such a crowded field. Until Ted Cruz finally dropped out, I think the number was that Donald Trump averaged about 38% in the Republican primaries. And in a really crowded field, that's still pretty impressive. And it was enough to get him a lot of delegates and put him over the top and so forth. But it still left the party not at all certain about their presumptive nominee at that point. So just before the convention, Donald Trump considered a number of people to be vice president, including Chris Christie and a couple of other people. And ultimately, obviously, he went with Mike Pence, the governor of Indiana, who hadn't really been a major player in the campaign. He very tepidly endorsed Cruz before the Indiana primary, which was the last really competitive fight in the 2016 primary season. But ultimately, Pence was the choice, and I think it reassured rank-and-file Republicans in a way that other choices would not have, certainly Chris Christie. Pence is a guy who doesn't make many unforced errors, and I really can't think of one that he made during this campaign. In fact, he did a lot of cleanup work for statements that Trump had made that most people couldn't have put together an articulate defense of. He gave a very good speech at the convention. It was kind of drowned out by the speech right before him where Ted Cruz refused to offer the endorsement, but Pence gave a very strong speech. His performance at the vice presidential debate against Tim Kaine was dominant. It not only wiped the floor with Tim Kaine, it changed the media narrative after weeks of Alicia Machado and other just landmines that Trump kept stepping on. Mike Pence proved that there was a steady hand at Trump's side. We've now seen him since Election Day playing a big role in the transition, probably making a big impact in who Trump chooses for different cabinet positions, which we've pointed out have been pretty impressive so far. So the fact that Mike Pence was the choice and is going to be the vice president with what appears to be a pretty heavy role in this administration is all good.
That is a really good choice. And I was about to say, if you're a traditional conservative, I think the night of the vice presidential debate was the best night of the presidential campaign.
Oh, absolutely. All right. On to worst idea, Jim.
All right. So I'm going to try to keep this down to less than 4 hours. I think the worst idea of the year was this notion that there were, I'm making air quotes as I say this, lanes in the Republican presidential primary. And that all you had to do if you were going to if you wanted to be the nominee was stay in your lane, win your lane, and then you'll be able to take on Trump. And we saw this amongst, you know, several candidates who all thought they were going to be the social conservative candidate. We certainly saw plenty who thought they were going to be the establishment candidate. We saw, you know, I guess you could say, you know, Cruz was trying to be full spectrum. Look, you know, Donald Trump didn't aim for any lane. He just aimed for Republican votes. And there was this idea of, well, look, first I'm going to knock off all these other guys, and then I'm going to knock off this guy. And eventually, it was almost like the NCAA tournament, except, you know, Trump had an automatic bid to the Final Four. And as a result of that, all of these traditional conservatives who, it's no secret, I preferred them a great deal more than Donald Trump, spent a lot of time spending a lot of money, resources, and attacking each other. We all remember Jeb Bush just dumping millions of dollars in negative ads against Marco Rubio, Cruz and Rubio going at it with each other, a bunch of guys who I thought were pretty good, like Bobby Jindal and Rick Perry, never got a chance on the big stage with the primetime candidates. This was a process that I don't think brought out the best in the conservative movement or the Republican Party. Some of that is on the fault of the networks. A lot of this is the fault of the candidates and folks like no offense to the fine Governor Jim Gilmore or George Pataki or some of these guys, but I think they were just taking up space on that stage. But as a result of that, all of that clogging made somebody like Donald Trump, the complete outsider candidate, the lone celebrity candidate, the guy who wasn't even was by no means a traditional Republican, stood out all the more because there were 15, 16 candidates who were basically competing for different subgenres of the Republican Party. I think people will be studying the Republican primary of 2016 for a long time. And ultimately, at its heart, it comes down to the tragedy of the commons that when Scott Walker, who was the first one to depart the race, came out and he said, look, we need to unite behind some conservative alternative to Trump or else this isn't going to work. Nobody took Scott Walker's advice, and Scott Walker was right. And that bit by bit, these candidates dropped out, but it never turned down to a one-on-one race. Thanks a lot, John Kasich. John Kasich, who ran a 50-state campaign to prove he could be president of Ohio, and who basically ensured that there was always at least two candidates splitting the number of Republicans who wanted an alternative to Trump. And also, it's worth noting for myself and everybody else who was a Trump skeptic, ultimately, the number of Republicans who wanted an alternative to Trump was smaller than we thought it was. So this was always a party that was more comfortable with Trump than we thought it was, and here we are. We're hoping for the best, and there's some signs for optimism from the Trump administration, and there's some not-so-good signs, and we'll see how things shake out from there. But I think a lot of campaigns really botched the way they approached this, and I would like to see the party, whether the next major Republican primary race is in 4 years from now, whether it's 8 years from now, I like to see us rethink to make sure we bring out the very best of our party through this process.
Yeah, casting a wide net is a pretty good idea, just rather than trying to win your lane, as you said. Very, very good. And that is exactly what a lot of people were doing, given all the attacks that were going in directions other than the front runner. My worst idea goes to the FBI. The FBI had a really bad year in a number of different ways. In addition to Comey laying out the case, as we talked about yesterday, against Hillary Clinton for 15 minutes, and then at the end saying, yeah, you know, there might not be a prosecutor who would actually push this case, so we're not going to recommend charges. That was bad enough. But, Jim, for me, it goes back. Their worst moment was Orlando. And twice they had Omar Mateen on the radar. Twice they interviewed him pretty extensively, it would seem. And twice, despite all the different concerns, they let him go. Even before the Pulse Club shooting in June, Disney had called the FBI. I think this was even after they had investigated him twice to say that he and his wife had been casing the park. And the FBI didn't even follow up on that. It's obviously hard given all these quote-unquote lone wolf cases up to many, maybe as many as 1,000 around the country that they're trying to investigate. Manpower obviously is limited to some extent, but it seems like warning signs were there and they were just missed not once but twice and then ignored a third time. And I'm not an expert on this stuff. I don't know what exactly the solution is or what they should have done differently in this specific case. But when you have somebody in the crosshairs that many times and you don't see the problem, that means our problem of radicalizing individuals in this country is a big, big problem that might not be that easy to confront.
Greg, is it too late for me to change my vote for best idea, our proposal for Disney CTU?
I was thinking really that one of us should have picked Disney CTU and the other was the Jim and Greg notice if anything's changed on HGTV.
Yeah, so we did have some happier, funnier best ideas, but no, I think it's a very good point there. Look, the other day on Twitter, I put out the question because, you know, there are polls that showed, lo and behold, Americans' faith in their institutions is lower than ever before. And I remember like thinking, and I put the question to people, what would it take for you to feel faith in American institutions again? And I got, you know, the wide variety of answers you'd expect. Hillary Clinton in handcuffs, yada, yada, yada. But I think things like this, the way the FBI, the way the government is handling issues related to Islamist terror very much shakes public's faith that they get the whole story from people in authority. So that carries over to my nominee for boldest tactic. But unless you've got anything else to add to the worst idea, Greg.
No, go for it. Boldest tactic.
Right,
what you got?
So, boldest tactic and a lot of good options here. I think I concluded that the heart of Trump's message that worked is his statement to, you know, quote unquote, the establishment. You could say the Republican establishment. You could say the Democratic establishment, the Obama administration, the media, economic leaders. I mean, you go down the list. We don't believe what you're telling us anymore. And you can apply this to issue after issue. We don't believe the economy is doing well. We don't believe that an insecure border is harmless. We don't believe that the term illegal immigrant is hateful or improper. We don't believe you when you say that crime is down. Now, obviously, in the long term, it is, but the murder rate in big cities jumped back up after Ferguson. And I would argue that the opioid addiction epidemic you're seeing all over the middle America brings a lot of crime with it. And if you see that, you feel like crime is getting worse. The American people do not believe that there is greater risk of an Islamophobic backlash against Muslims than there is as a threat of Islamist terror. They don't believe that the Orlando nightclub shooter did what he did, screaming Allah Akbar out of repressed homosexuality. You can go down the list. And ultimately, Donald Trump ran against the media from day one. And of course, the media was very happy to oblige. And for all of his flaws, and Lord knows there are many, just enough Americans looked at the way Trump described America and said, you know what? That's more accurate than what I've been getting told for the last 8 years. And I think that's at the heart of it. And I think that we have criticized the media for a long time on the right, and I think with good reason and with many fair criticisms. But I don't know if there's ever been a Republican candidate who basically said the media lies to you all the time and you shouldn't believe them, which is ultimately potentially very dangerous. Right? We do need some sort of trusted forms of communication. But ultimately, I think that was a key part of his victory, and I think it ended up it may have been one of those things that Republicans have been, you know, flirting with doing and needed to do before they could win a presidential election again.
Jim, that's an excellent choice. And you might even just spread that out to Trump's approach to the entire campaign was completely unconventional. Every step along the way, whether it was about staff, whether it was ground game, whether it was messaging, whether it was various positions on things, every time he said something or did something significant, everyone explained why it was stupid to say, why it shouldn't have been done, why it was wrong in terms of a policy. And every time, it never made a difference. There were so many times everybody said, well, this is it. That's not going to fly, and the American people are finally going to reject him.
Meltdown, as the Time covers kept saying.
But ultimately, either he understood the American people better than anybody else did, at least in the mainstream media and the Republican establishment, or it just was the perfect storm for him in 2016. Although that is not my actual choice here, but I do have to give him credit for that. Boldest tactic is one that was really controversial for a few weeks and then was hardly ever talked about again. In February, Justice Antonin Scalia passed away, and there was a Republican debate that same night, or I guess the night after he died. And on that stage, there were a number of Republicans who said point blank, there should not be a new justice nominated or confirmed this year. It should be up to the new president. We're already in the middle of an election cycle. Leave it up to the next president of the United States to decide that. Mitch McConnell quickly got on board. Chuck Grassley, the chairman of the Judiciary Committee, quickly got on board. And they never wavered despite intense pressure for quite a while from the White House and certainly from the media. The president nominated Merrick Garland, who was certainly portrayed as a moderate, kind of a compromise choice because of the fact that he was headed out of office in the next few months. And at no point did the GOP waver. And probably because Trump was the GOP nominee, the media spent all of its time focusing on him. And by late spring, early summer, other than when it came up maybe in a debate or two, when the Supreme Court came up as a topic, the issue was largely forgotten. And now as a result of the fact, obviously, that the Republicans won, it'll be Trump deciding who is going to be nominated for the Supreme Court and not Barack Obama. If the reverse had happened and had been a Republican president, I'm sure we would not have been very happy with the Democratic Senate in the majority doing the same thing. Whether you think it was the right thing to do, the wrong thing to do, it was extremely bold and it worked.
I think that's a really good choice, Greg. It's funny, as we're going to this, we talked about, you know, a couple of days ago, we did Top Figure Fading into Oblivion, and I went with the official demon of the Three Martini Lunch podcast, Harry Reid. But, you know, Merrick Garland is destined to be a Trivial Pursuit answer someday.
That's true.
Right? I mean, you know, name the Supreme Court nominee from President Obama who never got a vote or a hearing from the U.S. Senate in 2016. And, you know, people are just, you know, somebody like my departed friend Sidney Stoll will win Jeopardy that day for knowing the answer to that question. And maybe you can argue Merrick Garland deserves it. Maybe he doesn't. But it was kind of an interesting – it was not a turn of events I think a lot of people would have expected. And for all the people pointing, those wimps, those squishes, those Republican senators who never keep to their principle. Look, they said they were going to do this, and they did it, and it paid off very well for them.
It did, and we'll see probably fairly early in the new year who Trump's choice is to fill the Scalia vacancy. So, Jim, 4 out of 6 special editions are in the books. We've already done one that's pretty critical of the media, to say the least, but we're going to talk even more about the media tomorrow, so that'll be exciting. Talk to you then.
See you tomorrow, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks very much for being with us today, and be sure to tune in on Friday for the next Three Martini Lunch.